Sego. I'm John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio. Yeah, we will not be idle anymore. That's what Resistance Radio is about. It's about encouraging other people to step up to issues. We know that this station, or these stations, WBAI and WPFW, represent free speech radio, but speech alone doesn't get it done. You know, sometimes we've got to take a position and find ways within our communities to assert that position, find ways within other communities to sometimes stand up to oppression and the like. So when I start the program with Murray Porter's Stand Up CD and We Will Not Be Idle Anymore, is there's a reason behind that. All right, as I said, I'm John Kane. This is Resistance Radio. It is my pleasure to be on the air in Washington, D.C. on WPFW and in New York City on WBAI. But it requires you. It requires you to support not only the stations, but support the stations in the name of this program if you want this program to continue. Look, I know some of the things that I talk about are uncomfortable, and they are not necessarily, you know, the prevailing narrative on a lot of issues. And part of it is because of who I am, where I come from. And look, when we talk about free speech, I think it's great to speak out. And when you talk about stations like WBAI and WPFW, look, there are other stations around the country, other Pacifica stations. And look, there are other activists. There are other Native people that are on the radio. Native and people representing oppressed people all over the country. But in many places, the stations have some say on what is going to go on the air. WPFW and WBAI give me, at least at this point, nobody's ever told me there's something I couldn't talk about. They give me free rein. They know who I am, what I talk about, and frankly, like I said, I do speak out against many institutions and ideas that are supported by a lot of people, right or left. I mean, this isn't even just about being a liberal versus conservative or Democrat versus Republican. I don't even consider myself a part of that game. Where does my narrative fit in with culture wars and with political ideologies? I think other people will have to make that judgment, because I'm not signed up. I'm not playing that game. But in order for me to be here, we do rely on you. We rely on you, the listener. These stations rely almost entirely on donations from listeners. So I do ask that you support WPFW and WBAI. And I ask that you do it in the form of donations. That's how we do it here. And of course, there are a lot of programs like, you know, that exist on these stations that offer a premium, perhaps, or they offer a gift of some sort. And I've done it before, and I'll probably do it again someday. But for me, I donate my time. I donate my voice, and I donate the research that I do to do this show each week as my gift, not to the station, but to you. That's my gift to you. You know, for me, the program's the premium. So I'm hoping it's enough. And I hope those of you who listen to this station, listen to this program, feel that it's enough. And I hope that some of you, look, it'd be great if all of you felt compelled to support these stations. And I know some of you are listening on Facebook Live, or you're listening to this as a podcast, but you too. I mean, you can step up. You can call the stations. You can go online and you can make a donation. And look, we don't ask that you drain your bank account to support the station. I mean, we're asking you to do probably less than what you're doing for Netflix or, you know, Video Prime or your coffee each week. If you will become a sustaining member, or for WBAI, we call it a BAI buddy, you could do $5 a month, $10 a month. I mean, whatever you can swing. I mean, look, and if you could do as much as your Netflix account is, or your Disney Plus account, or whatever it is that you sign up for to watch television, that'd be great. And we would greatly appreciate that. And I personally would greatly appreciate that. I don't get that money. it I mean, there are paid staff. We've got the great Reggie Johnson, who's standing by my side with every show. But this is what they do for a living. So we need your support. We need your support to cover staff, to cover expenses, to cover the cost of being on the air. So please support these stations. If you're listening in New York City, the number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can go online, and it may even be a little easier just to go online and click the tabs and follow the prompts to become a BAI buddy or to do a one-time donation. And you can do that by going online to give2wbai.org. If you're listening in Washington, D.C., their number is 202-588-9739. Let me give it again, 202-588-9739. Or you can go online for WPFW at wpfwfm.org/donate. And there you can make your contribution. Again, you can become a sustaining member. And that or a WBA buddy, that just means that you're going to submit your credit card information to do a $5 a month donation, or a $10 a month donation, or a $20 a month donation. Or you can use your credit card information. Then you establish it, you set it, and look, you don't have to pay attention to it anymore. We'll that money will come to the station each month, and it really does help in a big way. Look, $5 a month doesn't sound like much, but if I've got 20 or 30 of you doing that, and I don't think that's unreasonable for 20 or 30 buddies or sustaining members to sign up to listen to this program. Look, as I sit here, I have no idea how many people are listening to my voice. I know some of you are, because look, we do call-ins, and we're going to do phone calls today. And I know you call in, and I usually have no problem, going to the next caller. So I know you're listening, and I know oftentimes when I open up the phone lines, I'm getting people who've never called in before, or they might be first time listeners or whatever the case might be. So again, I can't emphasize enough how important it is. And frankly, I don't want to, sound like the sky is falling, but this type of community radio is so dependent on you. And as such, we are kind of vulnerable. We don't have corporate sponsors, and we don't have, government money coming in to support these stations. So we depend solely on you. And sometimes our pitches to you to support these stations don't hit home enough, and we find ourselves under the gun. And for the most part, many of our Pacifica stations are almost in a constant state of really pressing you, the listener, to support these stations. So I'll bring it up again at the end of the program, but I really do feel it's important for me to impress upon you, the listener, to support this station and support this program. All right. So, I've been talking about the Indian Citizenship Act, and that's a law that was passed by the United States in 1924. In June, it'll be the 100th anniversary of that law. And look, this law gets characterized in a bunch of different ways. And, some people call it, we won the right to be U.S. citizens, or, or it was a grant, or however you want to, phrase it. But the bottom line is, it was a declaration by Congress. House and Senate, they just declared that we were citizens. Now, up to 1924, there were Native people who had become U.S. citizens through various ways. Some of it had to do with some of the lopsided treaty deals that were entered into, or the laws that were passed associated with taking our lands. And it's like, we're taking your lands, and we're going to make you U.S. citizens at the same time. And look, there have always been some Native people, just like we see people all over the world, that want to become U.S. citizens. And Native people were among some of those people. But the idea of declaring it and forcing it upon us, which is exactly what happened 100 years ago, is a problem. Because if I make a choice, and should I have that choice to be a U.S. citizen? Well, I guess, I think it would depend on where I lived. I live on a Native territory, so I don't know if I should be afforded that choice, because I believe where I live is not a part of the United States. But the vast majority of Native people who live in Native communities live in, on lands that the United States has claimed the title to, and they hold in trust for Native territories. So what does that mean? Well, or what does it mean if you're among the 70% of the Native population in this country that doesn't live on a Native territory? Why? Because of inadequate housing oftentimes, inadequate opportunities to earn a living or to prosper or to see some hope for the future. I mean, there's a lot of reasons that Native people don't live on Native territories. And in that, let me include also Native Hawaiians. I mean, a lot of Native Hawaiians can't afford to live in their homelands because of what the United States has done to Hawaii and what they've done to those people. So where does it leave us? Well, 100 years ago, they made this declaration. And here's the thing. There is a narrative, and I'm going to talk about some of the sources of that narrative. There is a narrative that suggests that people have been led to believe that this declaration in 1924 gave us the opportunity to have dual citizenship. In fact, the U.S. Mint, and many of you know, the U.S. Mint, they produce these coins, that these commemorative coins, and you know, there are various denominations, but the dollar coin, the one we call the Sacagawea coin, has all, on the flip side of that coin, has a variety of imagery, everything from, you know, iron workers to various people that they've, they've tried to commemorate, code talkers and the like, all kinds of things. I'm going to tell you, I'm not a big fan of the whole Sacagawea coin thing. For one thing, I view Sacagawea kind of like Deb Haaland. Yeah, she works for them. She didn't work for us. And the idea of using our imagery to, you know, I don't know, to adorn your money is, I'm not a big fan. I'll just leave it at that. But here's the thing. They did issue a coin this year to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Citizenship Act. And the U.S. Mint has a Facebook page. And on that Facebook page, they literally said that this was a landmark ruling that granted Native people the right to dual citizenship. And I got to tell you, that's simply not true. It's just not true. There is no sense of dual citizenship. For one thing, the United States doesn't recognize our nations, the peoples that we're associated with or the communities that we're from. They don't recognize us as nations with citizenry. No. They, in fact, what do they call us? They don't call us citizens. They call us tribal members, like we're a club. But here's the thing. If you think it's just about semantics, let me give you some facts. If you are a dual citizen, if you're a citizen of the United States and some other country, this country, the United States, cannot charge you taxes if you live in that other country and that's where you earn your income and that's where you live your lives. I understand, and I could be wrong. If I'm wrong, I apologize. But just an example, Chuck Schumer, the U.S. Senator from New York, from what I understand, is a citizen of Israel and a citizen of the United States. Now, I suspect Israel is not charging Chuck Schumer income tax on the money that he earns as a U.S. senator, as a politician for this government that he not only lives under and works under, but works for. And I would suspect that if Chuck Schumer or any U.S. citizens who have been granted citizenship in Israel, I suspect if they're living in Israel, whatever their occupation is, if that's where their lives are, I'm pretty sure the United States doesn't try to tax the income that they are generating and spending in Israel. But you know what? Even if you are an official, an elected official or a traditional position within a Native territory here in the United States, even if that's what your living is. I mean, look, everybody thinks about, well, what's it mean to be a chief? Well, is that a paid position? Well, some places it is. And of course, there are other types of governments that exist in Native territories where there's tribal chairmen, there's presidents, there's elected chiefs, all this stuff. And they are paid positions. And I realize most of you don't know this, but the United States charges income tax to Native people living on their territories, earning their living on Native territories, or attempts to. I'm not saying we are always the most cooperative. But in the eyes of the United States, they aren't recognizing our citizenship as Seneca or Mohawk or Oneida or Cherokee or, you know, Lakota or Anishinaabe. No. That's your tribal membership. You're American citizens, and if you earn income, it's taxable. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the states get to do that, because we've pushed more effectively against back on the states. But I'm not just talking about income tax. I'm talking about every kind of excise tax. The United States does not recognize our immunity or our tax-free status as it relates to federal taxes, excise taxes, income taxes, surcharges, all that stuff. So does the United States recognize our citizenship then? Of course they don't. No. So when they passed this law in 1924, they just declared that we were U.S. citizens. For those who weren't already, they declared the rest of us were. We weren't asked. There was no pathway to citizenship. There was no, okay, well, here's what you do. We passed this law. Now you can be a citizen. This is what you have to do. No, we didn't have to do anything. In fact, we didn't even have to know they passed it, and we didn't. Most of the laws that have ever been passed about Native people, we aren't consulted on them. We don't have a seat at the table. One of these things that essentially is a stark violation of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. No, we don't have a seat at the table. We hear about this stuff after the fact. Maybe a news channel calls, well, what do you think about the law that was just passed? Don't know anything about it. And that's how we learn about this stuff, right? Or the lawyers or the attorneys, the legal counsel representing someplace will offer some of the stuff. We are not an active participant in that legislative process. None whatsoever. So when they passed this law, we weren't asked. And in fact, many territories, especially the Haudenosaunee territories, the what people know as the Six Nations or the Iroquois Confederacy, we protested. Once we learned about it, we said, you can't do this. You can't just make us a U.S. citizen. And as it turns out, the rest of the world kind of agreed, in principle anyway, that you cannot strip away somebody's national charter or character and impose, it was called denationalization at the time. And this was already being introduced as a war crime as early as 1907 at the Hague Conventions in Europe. So this isn't just us feeling slighted here. The rest of the world viewed this very kind of activity as something that was essentially a war crime. The word genocide wasn't even invented yet. It wasn't discovered or developed. And the details or the defined charge that genocide represented, that wasn't really worked out yet. That wouldn't be until another, 20 years after they declared us citizens. And so what did that mean when they did that? Well, I'll tell you, there from almost an immediate outset, they felt like we were taxable now. Even though there actually is a provision on that law that said none of our personal or tribal property should be affected by this. Well, apparently our income is not our personal property. Or the sale of our labor is not personal property or tribal property. So even though it does have one provision in there, one caveat, it is so undefined that it's almost meaningless that it's even in there. But the fact of the matter is, whether the United States passed that law or not doesn't mean that we have to accept it. I'll sit here right now and tell you, I'm not a U.S. citizen. I'm Mohawk. I'm Gunjagahaga. I'm Ungwe Ungwe. Those are the words that we use to describe who we are. And I'm not saying it to insult Americans or U.S. citizens or whatever else. And I don't think I'm better or somehow above or superior to somebody, some lowly American citizen. No, it's not that at all. It's that I get to decide. I get to choose who I am, what I am. And if I have the opportunity to become a U.S. citizen, well, that's great if I want to exercise that. And look, there's a whole lot of Native people who've never given this that much thought. I mean, because what do we lose? What do we lose if we've lived our whole lives, wherever we've lived them, on a territory, off a territory? What do we lose if we say, no, we're not U.S. citizens? Can they deport us? Of course they can't. Of course they can't. So what is it we lose? They can't tax us anymore? Well, they're trying to tax us either way. But our ability to fight that becomes a little bit more impaired. So if we're not a U.S. citizen, we can't be asked to serve on Donald Trump's jury in New York City? I'll pass on that anyway. Or, I mean, so what am I denied? I mean, I know there are certain things that I'm probably not able to have availability to. I mean, there may be some grants, for instance, or I still have a Social Security number. That's not a citizenship document. And that means that I paid into a fund that I just started collecting from. That doesn't make me a U.S. citizen. There are plenty of people in the United States who are not U.S. citizens that work in the United States and pay taxes to the United States, you know, or pay into Social Security. And I worked a fair amount of my life. I wasn't always able to avoid paying federal income tax. I haven't done it in a very long time. But I still, obviously, whether you make a tax payment at the end of the year on April 15th or whatever else, doesn't mean you didn't necessarily pay into Social Security. I paid into disability insurance and to unemployment insurance as well. So, I mean, these are programs that are not tied to citizenship. And I know people say these things. Well, if you got a birth certificate, that means you're a U.S. citizen. No, that isn't what that means. A birth certificate is a certificate of live birth. It's proof that you were born and where you were born and maybe some sort of identification on what your name is and that kind of stuff. And it can be used for identification. It can be used to initially when I don't know how it is these days, but you had to bring your birth certificate to get your first driver's license. To get a U.S. passport, I understand you have to use a birth certificate. So it can be used for identification or for citizenship, but the birth certificate doesn't make you a citizen. So I don't know that a lot of people have thought this thing out, but I have heard Native people. In fact, AIM took the position that we were dual citizens. And so AIM, this is where kind of our paths, my path and AIM's path are a little different. AIM was very active in fighting for civil rights for Native people. But those of us who were involved in what we call the sovereignty movement, we weren't claiming, oh, we're sovereign on one hand and that we're Americans on the other hand. That, to me, that's hypocritical to do so. We also have a part of my culture, you know, one of our oldest agreements, our oldest wampum belts is called De Ojade. People call it the two-row wampum. And what the two-row wampum describes, initially, what the two-row wampum was about two paths across our mother. And we would always suggest that we were on one of those paths, and whoever we were engaging with this agreement, with this covenant, whether it was creation itself or whether it was another nation or other native peoples, we would say, we have separate paths. Now, we're separate paths on the same mother, on the same lands. And we are going to experience some of the same adversities across these lands. So we have a very shared experience, but we're not going to direct your path and you're not going to direct ours. So when white people showed up, they didn't have a path here. So we changed the analogy. We changed the metaphor a little bit. And we said, well, it's like two vessels on the river of life. You don't have a path, but you know, you got these boats and they make a big wake in the water. So we're going to describe this two-row wampum to you, initially the Dutch, as two vessels. Our vessels are smaller, but they're more nimble. They're canoes. And your vessels are larger, and they're designed for, you know, crossing large bodies of water. But we're not going to steer your vessel, and you're not going to steer ours. Nor are we going to try to straddle with a foot in each vessel. I mean, that was the analogy. So that two-row wampum is something that most Native people have some, or most, at least Haudenosaunee anyway, have a strong connection to. Now, we could argue how much we've straddled canoes or vessels over the years. Obviously, I'm speaking English to you. Wasn't a choice made by me anyway. But, you know, so there are certain things that we have been indoctrinated to. But it doesn't mean that we don't get to dictate our own identities. So for those of you who are trying to justify the Indian Citizenship Act as this landmark ruling that granted dual citizenship, that's simply not true. And look, I don't begrudge any Native person who has decided to live their lives as U.S. citizens. I don't. But I don't think that choice has ever been clearly laid out, or the ramifications of that choice. Because when the United States passed that law, they automatically assumed that they could subjugate us, that they could treat us as theirs. And look, for 100 years prior to that, they were already calling us wards of the state. They're already suggesting that we were incompetent and that we needed to have guardians or custodians manage our lives and our resources. You know, so our lands. I mean, there was a lawsuit a few years back called the Cobell suit, where a class action was brought forth against the Treasury Department and the Interior Department about the mismanagement of Native resources. And by some estimates, there was over $100 billion, that's with a B, $100 billion worth of Native resources that was either mismanaged, lost, or completely unaccounted for at the hands of the Interior Department. Yeah, that's that trust responsibility that we talk about, right? During the George W. Bush administration, they were saying, well, maybe we need to put a number on it. And they were coming with a number around $40 billion. But during the Obama-Biden administration, they settled the Cobell suit for $4 billion. Literally pennies on the dollar, so they could extinguish the suit. So, I mean, even that admission, I mean, $4 billion sounds like a lot of money. It's about what Seneca's casinos generate in 20 years. But it sounds like a lot of money. But it's not as much as what people think it is. And especially if $100 billion worth of Native resources has been lost in the process. So I just have to, you know, kind of quash this notion of this dual citizenship thing. Now, is there a pathway to have our Native citizenship recognized? No, that doesn't even exist. I mean, the Bureau of Indian Affairs may be able to keep track on who they consider tribal members or not, but it's not the same thing as as the United States recognizing that we have a citizenship tied to a place and a people that's not the United States. They simply don't recognize that. So, I mean, and look, some of you listening to this, and I know there's Native people who hear the show, some of you may not agree, but you only have to really kind of look at how much they impose upon us, even when we're on our lands. Like I said, imagine being elected a tribal counselor here on the Seneca Nation, and the United States somehow has the right to put a claim on 25 to 30% of that income that a Native politician serving his nation on his land or hers, on their land, that the United States has some stake in that income. There could be no more clear an example of the outright rejection of the United States to our Native citizenship than that. If they think that they can tax us on our land in any capacity, but you know, income taxes, when I think about a Native servant, a servant of their people, having, and the United States somehow having a hand in their pockets, it's just absurd to me. All right, so I'll tell you what we're going to do. I do want to take some calls. It's been a couple of weeks since we've done that. Reggie, are we available to do this? Can we pull this off?
Absolutely, of course.
All right, well, let me see. I don't remember the number, but I do have it written down. All right, here's the number in the studio line. It's 212.
Okay, there you go.
All right, 212-209-2877. Got that right, Reggie?
You are correct,
sir. All right, 212-209-2877. That is the studio in New York City. This show does rebroadcast in Washington, D.C. On Fridays. Hopefully, if you're maybe if you're in Washington, you listen online every once in a while so you can catch a live show and give a call. We've had some calls from all over when we've done this in the past. So I'm hoping that people will take us up on the offer. Maybe if you're listening even on Facebook Live, you'll pick up a phone and you'll give a call. Again, 212-209-2877. I'll also take this opportunity to remind people that we are listener-supported radio. And look, there's no connection to calling in to talk to this show and making a donation. There's no connection. I'm not fooling you. I didn't send you the pledge line by mistake. It really is a studio line. But you know what? Here's the thing. If you're going to call in to be on the show, when you get done, why don't you call the pledge line and make a small donation of some sort? I mean, just to be fair. I mean, I'm giving you the opportunity to be on the radio. And maybe it's an opportunity to yell at me because you don't agree with something that I said. I don't know. But you know what? I honestly did give the studio line. So please do join me for a conversation. And look, I talk about a variety of things. And I know some of you are probably saying, why are you keep talking about this Citizenship Act? Well, I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. I feel passionate about this issue because as we come on marking the 100th anniversary of this thing, I don't know why there isn't more conversation about it. I just don't get it. I don't know why there aren't more people talking about it. And you're probably saying, well, you're the only one I've ever heard talk about that. Well, you're probably right. And, you know, right now at the United Nations right now is the permanent forum on Indigenous issues. It's this week. I guarantee not one person down there is bringing up the anniversary of the Citizenship Act, which is technically a war crime. I mean, it's not only is it denationalization, but it fits into what we now know as the definition of genocide. You're stripping away our identity and you're imposing yours upon us. And there's no other way to really characterize it. I know we can, I talked about this idea of dual citizenship. Well, it's not that. So if you're wondering why I talk about this so much, it's because I feel strongly about it. And look, even before I talked about this specific act that is coming up on its 100th anniversary, you know I talk about Native identity all the time. That's why I do the mascot fight. That's why I talk so much about our identity and who we are. But so that's why. So again, let me give you the number one more time. It's 212-209-2877. That's the number to call if you want to be a part of this show, if you want to give, offer a question or a comment or a thought. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the subject that I talked about today. Obviously, I talk about a lot of Native issues, and I've had some great calls. I've had some of you call in and talked about some piece of history that you are aware of, accurate or otherwise, and I'm always willing to engage somebody on that conversation. So if anybody's online, Reg, just let me know, and we'll go ahead and we'll take a couple.
Of course, no problem.
All right. So again, the United Nations every year they do this. Well, they do a couple of things. They one in August they have like this Indigenous Peoples Day thing, and they do a couple of events. And I've gone to that, and I've actually spoken there a few times. I don't know that my commentary that's been offered at those events in August are well received by the moderators or the panelists sometimes, because I can't help it. I've got to call people out. I mean, they did one a few years ago that was about migration and movement. And I said, we're being forced to get U.S. passports to travel. We literally can't leave the United States. Well, except for maybe across the Mexican or Canadian border, I guess, without a U.S. passport or a Canadian passport or a Mexican passport. I mean, that's we can't produce our own travel, and we have produced our own travel documents, and we've had countries like Canada and others say that they're fake, that they're unlawful documents. So, and the passport issue would be one thing if we could get a U.S. passport just for the sake of the convenience and not have to declare U.S. citizenship as a part of it. But that's really what it is. And I've had people say to me, even at the UN, well, I've got a woman from South America. She says, well, I use a U.S. passport. Well, that means that you're a U.S. citizen. She goes, no, it doesn't change my identity. I said, it absolutely does change your identity. Why? Because you're using it for, as identification. It's kind of in the word. But, you know, and I'm not saying that she's not, you know, whatever South American country. I'm not saying that she's not a dual citizen. Because that in that situation, dual citizenship is probably recognized. But in our situation, if the United States would recognize our citizenship, I wouldn't be opposed to having a U.S. passport. I'm just not going to declare I'm a U.S. citizen to get one. I'd rather see us produce our own travel documents, birth certificates. And some nations do their own birth certificates. I think the Seneca Nation even does them, although they're used quite sparingly. And I don't know, frankly, I don't know if we showed up with a Seneca Nation birth certificate as a basis for an identification if the state or federal agency would recognize it. And how problematic is that? So, again, the number to call, 212-209-2877. That's the number to call to be a part of the show. Call in with a comment or a question. And, you know, I'll take all comers. So, you know, don't have to be shy. I'm not, and look, I've had some callers over the years. And when I first started on WBAI as a...
Okay, John, we got three callers holding.
Okay. When I first started as a host of my own show, I was told, you know, try to stay on track. Don't let the callers get too far off, far afield from the subject matter you're talking about. And I told the program director at that time, no, if somebody wants to call in, we'll talk about anything they want to talk about. And I had one caller, Michael G was my board operator at the time and my kind of a bit of a co-host like Reggie is. And a person called in and he declared right out of the gate that he's a white supremacist. I took the call and it was a spirited conversation, but he had a hard time defending who he was and what his position was, of course. But All right. So we do have a couple of callers. So caller, here's what, first let me say, turn your radio down. And when I introduce you as the next caller, I'm just going to ask what your first name is and where you're calling from. It's just about courtesy. So, all right. So, caller, Reggie, put the first caller on the line. And caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Hello.
Yep, you're up next.
That is you.
What's
Yes, hi. My name is Ethel. I'm calling from the Bronx.
Well, thanks for calling. First off, I really appreciate anybody who's willing to jump online with me. I really am.
Sure. You're welcome. I also like your show. I like what you have to say. And I wanted to do more research and learn more about the Native American culture and the different things that's going on in terms of Congress, because there's a lot of things. I forgot the judge that okayed. He was in, how you would say, he was in agreement with the water that flows from one place to another. I cannot remember the name of the judge. But it was about water and making sure that the people get water. I mean, simple things, basic human rights, is not, the people are not receiving.
Right.
So I wanted to know more about that.
Well, see, one of the problems is, and in fact, I'm going to say it here for the first time in the show, but I finally started to write a book. And the book that I'm writing is going to... The title is called Illegal Doctrines, because everybody has this notion of what a legal doctrine is, but they don't understand where they come from, or are they even right, or should they be legal? So the book, I've got one chapter done, but I address this idea that the United States doesn't just have laws that they passed. They have laws, they have things that they enshrine as law, like the doctrine of Christian discovery. Nobody passed that as a law. There's no statute number associated with it. But there are certain things like that. The trust doctrine is another one that gets accepted as foundational law. Another one is called the plenary powers doctrine. And when you bring up Congress, what the plenary powers doctrine is, and by the way, all three of those, doctrine of discovery, trust doctrine, and plenary powers doctrine, all came at the hands of the same judge, Chief Justice John Marshall, in the early 1800s. And the plenary powers doctrine is this notion that Congress... that the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, intended for Congress to have absolute authority over all aspects of native life. And so that becomes enshrined in law, even though it was never passed as a law. And frankly, it doesn't really have any constitutional support for such a thing. Even though the judge said that the framers intended that to be, he based it on one clause of the U.S. Constitution called the Commerce Clause that said Congress shall have the power to regulate the commerce in and among several states, interstate commerce, with foreign nations and with Indian tribes. And that's how this judge determined that Congress should have the plenary means ultimate power over all of aspects of Native life. So when Congress passes these laws, they almost can't be challenged. They can't be challenged on the basis of whether it violates the Constitution or not. Why? Because the courts, and the Supreme Court in particular, has created this legal doctrine that says Congress can pass a law and it's not beholden to any other system of checks and balances. But having said that, there are certain things that the United States has had to recognize, and rights to water is one of them. The problem is when you start trying to recognize that California has a right to water, and and all these other major cities have rights to water, you realize that with these river levels dropping, if you're on the bottom end of that river, that tributary, there may be no water left for you, and that's what's happened with the Colorado River and some of the people who live in Arizona. That they're being denied water because it's being used up before it even gets to them. Go ahead.
Did you know that there's something going on where people are I think they're called green something. They're buying up the places that had drought, and they're taking something to do with water also. And it was an article, I think it was Apple News, about a day or two ago.
I'll look for it. I'm not familiar with it. But at the end of the day, when you think about what Americans have done, they have tried to create these oases. Las Vegas is an example of it. You take a desert and you suck a bunch of water into the area. Well, at some point, you're using up water that may have had other usages. And and we've seen, look, part of the reason you had the fire in Hawaii has to do with the fact that you've got the tourist industry sucking up all the water, so you create these drought conditions. You alter the ecosystem. So, yeah, it is definitely a big problem. Look, I want to thank you for the call. I don't want to rush you off, but I'd like to get to a few other callers. But when my book goes on sale, I'll definitely be promoting it heavy on this on this station. So, by all means, stay in touch, and you'll learn a lot from what I've got to say, because I'll provide all of the background material as well. All right,
thank you. And check out that article. It was on yesterday or the day before.
I'll look for it. I'll look for it.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. All right. We'll go to the next caller. Caller, you're the second one up. So you're up next. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, is that me?
That's you.
Oh, hi. My name is Michael in Brooklyn, New York. I'm a little nervous. I say hi to you, John, and I forgot the host's name. I'm a little nervous. I just started listening to you recently. The first time I heard you, I think it was last year, you had me in tears. I love your program, and it's hurtful to me as what your people went through.
Well, to be clear, we're still going through a lot, and I think that's the point, and that's the reason for doing this show is to let people know what's really going on and what has gone on. So I appreciate that sentiment. You got a comment or a question you wanted me to address?
Well, yeah, I have a question. Well, I mean, I was honest, dude. That's just how I felt. But the question was, I remember you had a show where you mentioned how they brought Christianity over to the country. Because I'm a Christian, and you said, like, what is a soul? I mean, you said, I don't know if it was, like, last year. Do you remember that? You said a lot of things. But you said, what is a soul? So you said that, what do you mean? Do you don't believe in, like, an afterlife? You don't believe in a spirit, or, like, when you die, you don't believe you have a soul or spirit? Like, we all do. But I remember you said that. You said, like, what is a soul? I don't know if he was joking.
No, I wasn't joking. And I realized that many religions do, especially the three main dominant religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Mm-hmm. They all have kind of the same basis. They all come from the same place, as a matter of fact, Abraham, right? So, a lot of this is based on the some of the same philosophies about heaven and hell and soul and all that other stuff. But many peoples never had that as a part of their culture. And I don't even want to say religion. I don't believe that I have a religion. But I will say, as a Native person, I acknowledge my relationship with creation. And I don't want I'm not trying to deify creation, but and I mean everything. I mean, I think we are all related in some way. And you know, some people say, well, that's a very spiritual thing to say. And if that's the way people have to embrace this concept of our relation to not just living things, but all things on the planet, then that's right. What my culture teaches me. So no, I don't, my afterlife, I see it every day with my children and my grandchildren. That's my afterlife. And I don't know where the origins of this notion of heaven and hell and afterlife, burning in hell forever, or, you know, rejoicing with God, it comes from. But I got to suspect that some of that is metaphor. And some of it is not necessarily the way people, you know, illustrate it in cartoons or in movies and that kind of stuff. And when I suggest that I do have an afterlife, that afterlife isn't even just my genetic afterlife. It's what lives have I touched in my lifetime? And so what part of me continues when I'm gone? And I don't mean my physical part, and I'm not even talking about my spiritual part, but the impacts that my life has had. So yes, do I think that I'm going to touch future generations? I hope so, and I hope that my life has left a positive impact on future generations. But you know what? Whether it's acknowledged, or whether I'm remembered, or whether I just contributed through my children and my grandchildren and perhaps some deeds that I've done, it doesn't have to be acknowledged. I don't think that there's, you know, St. Peter sitting at a gate at the end of my life to give me my report card on my life. And people have different, and I'm not trying to make light of Christianity. Obviously, that's one of those cartoons I'm talking about. But I don't condemn people for feeling or for believing what they believe in either. So if you are a Christian and you believe certain things about afterlife and you believe certain things about what that means, I mean, honestly, one of the things that I always had trouble with in terms of one of the basic Christian tenets was that we are essentially born inherently evil, and that it is only through the grace of God that we can be good. I don't necessarily buy that, and that's a basic, you know, pillar of canon of Christianity, and it's through baptism and through accepting Jesus Christ that you even have an opportunity to have a promising afterlife. Otherwise, you're going to burn in hell. I just think the idea, I mean, the question was once asked by a Native person to a priest. So if I didn't know anything about Jesus Christ, would I still would I still have burnt in hell for not accepting him? And it left the priest somewhat in a bit of a quandary. And he said, no, if you weren't rejecting Jesus because you didn't know, then you wouldn't burn in hell. And he says, well, then essentially what you did is you brought this threat to me. You brought this evil to me in the form of your belief system. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's the best answer I have for it.
I mean, you know, answer my question. Yeah, you answered John my question. Yeah, in a way, but this conversation could go on a long way, and I know you have other callers. But like, do you believe in God, or I know you believe in nature, like the rivers and things like that, or do you believe like for instance, in the Bible, the first chapter or verse was God create the heaven and the earth.
No, I don't believe any of that. But I don't have to believe in a river because I can see a river. See, I don't have to. My life doesn't have to be based on belief. It can be based on experience, on what you see, what you touch, what you feel, what you taste. You know, but it also can be on what you feel. I mean, so emotions are real. So I guess some of that is there. But no, I don't believe in I don't believe in divine creation. Nor do I believe that anything that good or frankly evil that's ever happened was the product of a divine intervention. Let's face it. God was responsible for, you know, according to the Bible, for some pretty evil deeds, things like killing people by flood and, you know, and various plagues and that kind of stuff. So I don't believe that, in the words of Neil deGrasse Tyson, if you believe that God is all good and all knowing and all powerful, then you can't reconcile those two beliefs. Because if he's all powerful and all good, then you can't explain things like natural disasters, because he could have stopped those. And if he didn't, then he's not all good. So there's things that are irreconcilable about religion and about and Christianity in particular. And so it's real easy for me not to to get engaged in that kind of belief system. Look, Michael, I appreciate the call. I appreciate the question. And perhaps as we go through, maybe I'll do a whole show on religion versus not religion, I guess. We'll do that at some point. All right, let's try to go to another caller. We still got one on the line there, Reg?
I will hope so. Then this will be the last caller, so go at it, John.
All right, caller, you're up next and you're up last. So what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Jerry. I'm also from Brooklyn. And I think the last question was interesting, and I'm interested in your answer. So if you do a program about that, I'd listen. I got something kind of you brought up earlier, but some going back a couple of weeks, you talked about a whitey. Is that a driver's license? Is that what you talked about?
No, what I talked about, there was this thing that was developed as a part of the Department of Homeland Security. It was called the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative. And they tried to... they actually called it witty, which I thought was kind of interesting.
I understand, John. That my question really goes a little further than that. I'm sure Reggie knows this. I don't know if you do, but New York State, if you're a resident of New York State, it issues what's called an enhanced driver's license.
Right. Yes, I'm aware of those.
And you can travel to Canada, Mexico, and some Caribbean countries. The only thing you can't go by air. You got to go by sea or land.
Right, right. I am aware of those.
Eligible.
I don't have an enhanced driver's license. I have the old style, but which I'm not sure. I think they're actually going to phase those out. The question becomes: is that driver's license a citizenship document, and rather than just a residence
only
document?
I'm reading from the DMV inside because I didn't know. I thought maybe you'd have that. It says, only U.S. citizens who are residents of New York can apply for the enhanced driver's license.
So there you go.
Otherwise,
so,
you've got to get a real ID, which allows you to fly domestically, but doesn't allow you to go internationally.
So there you go. I mean, in other words, if you don't comply with U.S. citizenship, you're being denied the right to travel. And so what does that say about a people like me who the United States has tried to impose their citizenship on, and did it in a way that would essentially be illegal as far as the rest of the world is concerned? Because if you say flat out, we're going to strip somebody's national or cultural character and impose ours upon them, because before 1924, there were a lot of Native people who could not be U.S. citizens. So when they passed the Indian Citizenship Act in 1924, they didn't say, now you can. They said, now you are. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. I know, and I've heard you speak on this before. But the point is I don't remember. And it's going back just a couple of years now when I got it renewed. I'm an old timer. I'm 84 years old, so I don't remember whether they asked me on my driver's renewal whether I was a U.S. citizen.
Now, do you have an enhanced driver's license or just a regular one?
I got a real ID because I have a passport, so I can travel. I can travel internationally.
Did they ask for your passport when they issued your real ID?
Oh no.
Okay.
No. They had my old. When yours comes due, because you've got an old driver's license, right?
Right.
So when it comes due, you're going to have the choice only between this what they call the real ID, which is essentially what you have now, except you can use that real ID to travel domestically by airplane. Mm-hmm. But if you choose the enhanced, which is more expensive, I agree.
Well, it's not really about the expense. But you know, part of the there's also I'll just mention it briefly because I'm almost out of time. The United States tried to also promote what they called enhanced tribal IDs, which had some of the same characteristics as an enhanced driver's license. The problem is other countries weren't bound to recognize these things. So the United States, if you entered the United States with a enhanced driver's license or enhanced ID, they would accept it. But there's no guarantee that Mexico or Canada was going to accept them. So it's more complicated than that.
I'll just finish with the DMV says New York's enhanced driver's license is compliant with the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative.
That's it. That's why we're witty.
By air travel. Yeah, no, I agree. But you can travel by land or sea. If you want to go to Canada, no problem for you. I mean, a Europe state, so you could go easily there with that license. I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just trying to.
No, I understand what they're all about, but a lot of it has to do with citizenship compliance, and that's where it becomes problematic for those of us who want to suggest that we are citizens of our respective nations, not the one that was imposed upon us 100 years ago. So, look, Jerry, thanks for calling. I appreciate the conversation, and I'm going to be beating on this one for a while here. So. We'll have additional conversations, so perhaps you can join me again. Reggie, I want to thank you. Again, support WBAI and WPFW. I am John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio. Yahweh.